Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good. We were just joined by two guests, I believe. So we may have both of our guests on tonight.
All right. Well, why don't we connect those two individuals? And assuming that that's who it is, I'm going to introduce each of them. We'll start with our good buddy Alvis Bridges, who is a writer, video producer, and social media entrepreneur focused on the human side of accelerating change. He's worked extensively in reality and documentary television, co-founded Future Portal Memebox.com, and serves on the board of the Acceleration Studies Foundation. Alvis blogs about the present-day human creativity explosion, which he sees as an autocatalytic component of broader acceleration and near-term social change at socialnode.com. Alvis, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Hey, Phil and Steve. Thanks for having me back here.
Excellent.
Well, always a pleasure having you on. And we're also very delighted to welcome for the first time Vanessa Mimas, who is a futurist and digital ethnographer, researching what is happening at the intersection of technology, communication, and culture, and how we're impacted as a society, and what that means for the future. She's recently completed a master's in media studies at the New School in New York City. Vanessa, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you, and it's very nice to meet you. So we've got a terrific topic this evening, and I want to kind of ease into talking about the future of Facebook. Alvis, we talked about this project a little bit. You gave us a little bit of a teaser about it when you were on, what was that, about 2 months ago. But I wonder if we could start off by talking about how this project came to be, why you're working on the future of Facebook, and then we'd like to spend a little time talking about how the whole Kickstart project, how that whole Kickstart process works. So why don't we start with you, Vanessa? Tell us a little bit about what got you interested in the future of Facebook and what you're hoping to accomplish with this project.
Well, Future of Facebook is the pilot project that we're launching in the broader thing that we're kind of working on, which is Open Foresight, which is a process we're developing for collaboratively building visions of the future together with public experts and wrapping that all in together into these video, very very rich video products. So we chose Facebook because of its larger social significance in the evolution of web and social media technologies and how we're now able to connect with one another on a global level.
So tell us a little bit about Open Foresight. What's that all about?
Alvis, you want to take it away?
Yeah, sure. So, like, as Vanessa just mentioned, this process that we're working on is called Open Foresight. And very generally speaking, it allows people to build visions of the future together in a very open way. So we start out by coming up with a topic area. It could be anything. It could be the future of your school. It could be the future of your neighborhood. It could be the future of Facebook, which is our pilot project, and then we use a tried and true futures structure such as the STEEP methodology, which is just a simple categorization structure. In this case, that breaks down the project into, you know, five categories: society, technology, environment, economics, and politics. So we know we're going to be looking at the project through these lenses. Then we construct a questionnaire. We gather the best and the brightest bloggers and social media experts and other folks who have something interesting to say about the topic. We interview them on video. We open it up to the public as well. We've got the same 15 questions up on Quora right now, for example. And so, you know, this initial data that we gather through crowdsourcing is then processed together into a series of very easily digestible videos, one for each topic area, and then we aim to create one longer feature length, 12 or 14 minute, you know, web feature length, feature of video for that given topic. And the idea is that this process creates a product that the general public can then digest and consume, thus upgrading their kind of vision of the future and then allowing them to build on top of that. And we thought that Facebook in particular was sorely in need of this type of, you know, knowledge sculpting, if you will.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think this is a terrific approach. And when you talk about it being open foresight, the idea is that others can come and affect the same kind of treatment on things that they're interested in exploring the future of?
Oh, exactly. I mean, I left out the best part there. The idea is that all of the material is assembled and ascribed an open Creative Commons license that allows other people to then grab pieces of that and to remix it into products of their own. So kind of paying it forward, you know, to other researchers and other, you know, media folks who want to then, you know, experiment with that and take that huge body of content, you know, that ultimately we can only distill down into, you know, 20 minutes of, you know, really cool video. I mean, there's going to be hours and hours and hours and, you know, pages and pages and pages of just awesome information that people want to share about this topic. And so that goes back into the system and hopefully, you know, propagates other works.
That's very exciting. That sounds terrific. And so, how did Kickstart factor into getting this thing going?
Well, okay, I can take that one. So I did a project in the fall, a Future of Money video, that kind of got me on the level with thinking about doing these kind of future focused videos, and we just used PayPal donate buttons to create like a structure similar to a Kickstarter on a website and just kind of ask the general public to help us fund the creative process. We kind of put it out there on faith saying, we're going to do this either way, and if you want to kind of be a part of it and support it, great. If we raise nothing, we're still doing it. And we ended up raising like over $6,000, so that was very encouraging. So this time we thought we'd take it to Kickstarter, which is more structured and has a larger community already involved there, and asked for a $5,000 goal, and we are now, I think, 15 or 16 days into it, and we just actually hit our $5,000 goal the other day, so we're actually now over, I believe, 5,300.
Well, congratulations. Yeah, I noticed that Alvis's status on chat says funded with a big
exclamation
point. That's great. So you've got the money. So that means this is like the green light to go ahead and do the interviews and actually put all the materials together that you've been talking about.
Well, we kind of took almost the same approach. I mean, we started interviews in, I believe, early January, and we've been at it now doing a couple of weeks for, 2.5 months. We just had an interview today, yesterday. We have three more tomorrow. So we're just trying to kind of still go through the interview process in tandem, in parallel with doing the transcriptions and starting to pull out those quotes, and we already assembled our teaser video, which was launched with the Kickstarter to give people an idea of who we've been talking to and what the kind of content area looks like. So that's already up on Kickstarter. It's been a very busy process, kind of trying to communicate with the public, talk to the experts, blog, raise funds, keep in touch, all at the same time.
So it sounds like a lot of balls in the air at the same time. So you've been conducting the interviews. I guess I'm a little confused as to whether this is now a project that has been approved or it's a project that's completed, or where exactly are you guys with this?
Well, the idea was that you know, we realized that to play the Kickstarter game, we needed to put up something cool, right? So we did have to, you know, start the project a bit early, understanding that we would need funding to really complete it. So we've done all of the, you know, for the bulk of the interviewing. I mean, it's still going on, but I think most of that's finished. But really, these funds are to enable, like, post-production. We're starting to cut our first of the five focus videos right now, which is going to be the Society video. And, you know, that's a pretty intensive process, like using After Effects for graphics and laying those out and doing the voiceover, which Vanessa's going to totally rock. I think we're about halfway through the production process. We've gone through pre-production and through most of production, and then post-production I think is going to be the most intensive of them all.
So, and I'm sorry, which video did you say you were working on? You gave a particular topic name.
Oh, sure. Sorry. The first of the focus videos that we're going to be releasing, or vision videos, as we're now calling them, is going to be Society. So the future of Facebook seen through the lens of Society, a four-minute, very visually rich, graphic-rich video with some voiceover and some of the interview clips playing behind that. But ultimately something that's more visual than just talking heads, because we found that that's absolutely essential, like, for people actually wanting to watch, you know, something about this topic.
Absolutely. Okay, so when you see the, for example, Society video, you might hear from Kevin Kelly and Gary Golden, or it's not the quote-unquote interview with one person. It's different people that you've talked to talking about aspects of the future of Facebook that are related to the overall topic of Society.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you'll hear Kevin Kelly talk about it as, you know, Facebook as an intelligence amplifier. You'll hear people like Doug Rushkoff and, you know, David Siegel, you know, talking about the dangers of, you know, Society handing all the keys over to one corporate entity. You know, you'll hear from a bunch of different people. It's meant to be, you know, we're looking to take what everyone has said, distill it down into the main areas, and, you know, present alternatives in terms of it could go this way or it could go this way, like really just kind of boiling it down into interesting facts and scenarios, so that people can get a sense of what everyone is saying rather than, you know, one particular Facebook prediction. It's not about that at all.
So in the time, this is the question for each of you. We'll start with Vanessa on this one. In the time that you've been working on this project, and it sounds like you've got a couple of months of pretty intense activity in on it, and particularly since you've been conducting these interviews, here's my question. How has your view of the future of Facebook changed through the conversations that you've been having?
Oh, well, I've never thought so much about anything in one period of time, that's for sure. I've not looked at every single aspect of what Facebook means for society and life. I guess just the most interesting aspect is not so much thinking about Facebook itself as a company, but more thinking about us, the user base, or anyone who's connecting to another person on the planet, and really, I guess, the bigger picture of what's happening here with this social connective tissue layer that's forming as a basis for, you know, what they're calling the social web, and thinking about what comes after that, like what's going to be the next phase. Like we're still so young in the process of knowing what it means to be connected to other peers or people on the planet. And then when we're sharing information with one another, asking ourselves, you know, how much is too much? Who's watching that information? You know, there's a lot of talk about government surveillance and like autocratic regimes and regulatory scrutiny when thinking about Facebook possibly being a platform that enables actual value exchange and who's going to be in charge of watching, you know, who's going to be in charge of watching that and taking a cut of it, basically. And then just thinking at the bigger level. So if there would be a structure, whether it's going to be Facebook or it's going to be something after Facebook, that's just going to allow this to be without any roadblocks, what kind of a world could that enable of the way we're able to interact with one another, share information, show each other our lives, and create new business opportunities, new educational opportunities, really, really fundamentally changing how we operate in life. So it's big.
It's huge, absolutely. It's amazing the extent to which we live in a social media world today. I mean, almost without noticing it, it seems to have happened. And touching on one of the issues that you mentioned there, or kind of tangentially, I suppose, I tweeted a link from Popular Mechanics Day. I didn't actually read the story. I intend to go back and read it at some point, but the title was interesting enough to me. It was, "What happens to your data when you die?" You know, and there's this whole issue of, you know, you've got these logins and you've created this profile and you've created these relationships and there's this whole presence of a person. What happens to all that when a person dies? And, you know, that wouldn't be an issue if it weren't true that we really are sort of creating this additional layer of our lives, this infrastructure around ourselves that suddenly is still there. I've got a good friend on Facebook who used to be part of this show, used to be part of this blog, Michael Sargent, and he's still on Facebook. You know, I mean, his page is still there. And he died in, what was it, Stephen, about 2 years ago now. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been 2 years, yeah.
It'll be 2 years in a few days. It's, you know, the reality that we're not quite prepared for is this tissue that you described, Vanessa, really has become completely intertwined with our lives in a way that maybe we weren't completely prepared for. But here it is.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. One of the interviewees we had, Rita King, and Alvis, correct me if I have the number wrong. I believe she said it was 30,000 people a year who have Facebook accounts pass away. And so basically we have this kind of digital graveyard that's forming that people find comfort in being able to go back to Facebook pages of, you know, friends and family members who have passed away and look at their online history and the photos they've posted and the comments that their friends have posted about those photos and people being able to even check in after the fact and continue to leave comments as if that person is going to see it, but just, you know, kind of almost part of this cathartic healing process now that we can all kind of be a part of.
Absolutely, yeah. And I note your comments about the role of government. I saw a piece just earlier this week about government agencies putting ideas out on Twitter, putting stuff up on Facebook, trying to create momentum around certain ideas, which I thought was really interesting. But something I wrote I posted it to both blogs earlier this week was a piece about how easy it's become for regular private citizens to record telephone conversations. There was a time when that was kind of challenging. You know, that wasn't something that everybody could just do. And now there's like, you know, there's services where you can dial in and you can record all your phone conversations if you want to. So there's this kind of empowerment of individuals getting control of data that suddenly we're able to do, as I said in my blog post, suddenly we've got some of the same power that used to belong strictly to the paranoid police state. Right now it's like, you know, we can all be Big Brother to a certain extent with this access that we have to the data, and raises really interesting questions about what it turns society into when you've got potentially a conflict between, if not even conflict, just a competition between very powerful structures like the government or like Facebook itself or Google and individuals who are also kind of spreading their wings a little bit and figuring out their own sort of space in this and their own means of control.
I absolutely agree.
So, Alvis, same question to you. How have your views of the future of Facebook altered since you've been working on this project?
Well, you know, I would say the main thing is, like, you know, I've now seen so many different – I've seen and heard so many different visions of Facebook that my own vision of it has just significantly expanded. You know, there are, you know, probably, you know, 50 or 60 different scenarios that I just had never, you know, had never connected in my brain. So, like, they just, you know, I never envisioned them, and so I wasn't able to build on top of them. So, like, I would say, like, the first and foremost, like, interviewing all these folks has just developed such a rich simulation of the variable futures of Facebook. You know, and I didn't fully expect that. I expected maybe, okay, like I'll have, you know, somewhat of a change, but, you know, it's really notable. In particular, I'm fascinated by the amount of choices that Facebook has ahead of it, itself as a company. You know, it could go so many different ways. Facebook could simply fade into the background and become, you know, social utility layer. That's what a few people talk about. You know, Facebook, you know, could absolutely just, you know, it could wither and die in the face of, you know, richer, more creative competition, you know, that comes from left field. Facebook could grow to dominate certain sectors of the economy and not others, you know, remaining information and foregoing entry into the entertainment space. Or, you know, now as we're kind of seeing, you know, with Facebook's, you know, kind of partnership, you know, with, you know, various film companies that they've been talking to, you know, in order to bring, you know, movies directly to people through Facebook, it seems to be at least, you know, testing the waters of jumping into the entertainment distribution realm. You know, that, and then throw in, you know, just jumping out, you know, the 2015, throw in the evolving metaverse and evolving mobile technologies and the Internet of Things and this whole convergence of factors, and, you know, the future of Facebook becomes very interesting. You know, it could go in even more different directions, and it could grow huge and still not be the biggest player. You know, like, so, you know, I think that's what's fascinating to me, is that seeing, I guess hearing through most of our interviewees the reality of acceleration, and just seeing that it's tremendously difficult to truly predict which way Facebook will spread over even the next 3, 4, 5 years. Like, it's unprecedented, the change environment that company is going to have to exist through. So I guess that's my main takeaway.
I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, last November, the inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, he criticized Facebook in particular and social networking generally being, you know, leading to a bunch of walled gardens where, you know, people are, you know, the information is not as democratic as it is, obviously, in his World Wide Web. I tend to disagree with what he's talking about. As long as it seems to me, as long as Facebook doesn't take over everything, and we still have the option of having a completely, you know, open network, the internet, as well as Facebook. It seems to me Facebook actually increases the amount of information out there, because you have a lot of people that would that share things on Facebook that they wouldn't share otherwise. If, you know, a lot of people wouldn't just put their, you know, pictures of the kids or whatever on just out there on the internet, but they'll share it with you know, their Facebook friends. It seems to me it's just, all it does is it increases the amount of information. You know, I'd like your take on that.
Sure. I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right that Facebook has, and I think Kevin Kelly, you know, hammers this one home in our interviews, is that in that Facebook increases social complexity. It has increased social complexity to this point. I think that when arguing about whether or not it's good or bad that Facebook is this kind of walled garden, I think it's important to you know, also talk about when in the developmental process of social media, you know, evolving, is it good or bad? You know, when does it become too close? You know, I think certainly to this point, as it still continues to spread and train up a whole world of people in social media, I think, you know, I'm more convinced generally by the argument that that's a good thing so far. You know, but I definitely hear what the other folks are saying about the fact that, you know, because Facebook is so dominant, it shuts off, you know, it discourages people from imagining what could happen on the open web. You know, and we have certainly have had a lot of proponents of the open web and of and folks actually who, you know, who advocate, you know, Facebook not growing too large because it, you know, to use some of their own words, it seems to be swallowing the web. And it wants, you know, Facebook, you know, one of the possible futures for Facebook is that it becomes a massive web 2 that is a huge walled garden that people still use because it's so convenient. you know, that type of future is one to be wary of. But, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we want to do this project, because, like, who knows exactly what the next move that makes the most sense is for Facebook. You know, like, do they move towards that? You know, do they move towards, like, fading out? Do they move towards opening up in response to other services? You know, like, what happens when they clash with governments and all that? I think those issues are things that Facebook management and Mark Zuckerberg absolutely just thinks about all the time. And I think that things are moving so, you know, dynamically that he doesn't even know exactly which way he's going to be forced to go. Like, he doesn't kind of want to play his hand too early, which is probably why Facebook has backed off from making, like, public forecasts or statements related to these kind of, like, sweeping ideas of itself. Yeah.
Well, same question to you, Vanessa. What do you think about the whole walled garden issue? Good thing, bad thing? Is it a correct characterization of Facebook?
Well, I feel like I've heard a lot of people's change agents' big visions of the future, and most of, and in terms of how social media technologies can be utilized to really make something interesting happen, positive change in the world, and pretty much all of them require the social layer component first. Like, you really can't build anything until you have the people there. Again, back to Kevin Kelly, one of his maxims that he said was that community precedes commerce. So until you have the people there, you can't really rally them to do anything. So in terms of that, like, I think, again, with or without Facebook, we see now of the importance of having a social layer to the web, because it just is what we need in order to communicate and do things on top of that. In terms of being a walled garden, I guess, you know, when I think about Facebook, my issues are that, I mean, I don't really see too much crazy functionality that really adds value or allows me to, like, add value to the world. I'm able to, you know, the way that I use Facebook is I'm friends with the people that I know in my life, and I, you know, I use it to kind of keep up with, ambiently aware of what friends are up to, and, you know, it's an event planner where I know what things are going on in my area with my friends, you know, see their new baby photos or whatever, and that's it. I mean, it's kind of very lightweight to me, and I think that's just, it's nothing yet, even scratching the surface of what's possible, and I think there's a huge opportunity for faith.
I'm sorry, Vanessa, are you still with us? Kind of dropped off there
cut out there for a second. Can you guys still hear me?
Okay.
Yeah, we can hear you, Alvis. I haven't trouble. I haven't heard Vanessa here in a second.
Oh, am I there now?
Go ahead, sorry.
We hear you now.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I don't know where I cut out there. But, okay, so just kind of like a wrap up of the walled garden statement. I think, I guess two things that kind of irritate me is that on the one hand, you're kind of, it is free to use Facebook, so you can't really, I guess you can't ask a business to, you can't ask too much when they're free to you, but it is rather irritating that anything that you say on Facebook is being monitored, and then, you know, those preferences are being mapped as to your profile and your social graph, and then you have these ads that are, you know, highly targeted and customized, and, you know, it feels rather exploitative sometimes, and I don't really pay attention to the ads. So, you know, that whole thing is, it is what it is. I don't know that the advertising model is the best thing that's out there. It is what it is. And then on the other hand, again, the facilitating of opportunities to connect on a level that would actually allow people to generate value together. So maybe if Facebook could implement more mechanisms that would really encourage more entrepreneurship or people that are maybe within a certain locale, like a geographically local area in your local city, finding people with common interests or initiatives, projects, and being able to kind of dynamically cluster those people or show you in your news feed or whatnot, like, here's 18 people who live within 15 miles who also want to do that you know, light bulb exchange program and get the city, you know, on an energy saving thing or whatever. It would allow you to find those people so that you can get together and do something. I think that would make Facebook very interesting and valuable beyond just the very, you know, the valuable thing that's offered now of just allowing people to be aware of one another. So it's kind of like I feel like what Facebook is right now is only step one into God knows how far along they've thought it out, but I think it's just the beginning.
Yeah, there's definitely room for additional dimensions, and we'll get to some of those in a minute. But before we completely leave the walled garden thing, where I think Berners-Lee was going with that, and this is actually a concern that I share, is that Facebook is a place where your social graph exists. It's where all your information is. You can put it in there, but you can't get it out. I think that was Berners-Lee's objection. It comes down to a question of who does my social graph belong to? Does it belong to me, or does it belong to this corporation called Facebook? Well, you know, I've got a pretty good case that it belongs to me. I'm the one who made all the connections. I'm the one who said I'm friends with this person. I'm not friends with that person. I like these things. I don't like those things. I'm the one who wrote my status updates, what have you. So that social graph is my definition of me. Now, Facebook's argument is, you used our infrastructure to do this. We provided this for you free. Therefore, that whole outline of who you are is something that we can keep here and you can't take someplace else. My analogy is it's kind of like a bank that won't let you take your money out after you've deposited it there. That's not a perfect analogy because I can go deposit the same, you know, I haven't lost anything except for my time, right? I can go deposit the same social graph someplace else. It will just take a long time to recreate it. And from a business standpoint, you can understand why Facebook wouldn't just want to you know, give that up necessarily. But it seems to me that that's the concern, which is that we're kind of partners with Facebook in creating the social graph. But when push comes to shove, who owns the social graph? Alvis, do you think you own it, or do you think Facebook owns it?
You know, I think that's a pretty complicated question. I think technically, legally, right now, Facebook owns the biggest social graph that we've ever created. I think that, you know, it seems fair to me that I would generally own my social graph. I think that, in general, there's a bigger question at hand, and that is, does everybody own everybody's social graph? You know, like, you know, does the world have a right to the max quantification of the system? You know, if we feel if we feel compelled to get the best get as good as we can at futuring and, you know, pencil in our history to every fine detail, finding every little artifact, finding where Atlantis was, finding out exactly what the personalities of those people were before they lived, you know, does that then extend back into the now, you know, forward and then back into the now? I think that Mark Zuckerberg believes, you know, and according to Mark Zuckerberg's second law, it seems inherent in that. The second law being the observation that social sharing is doubling every year, roughly. You know, the outcome of that, you know, which seems to be a square to accelerating change in general, is that, you know, that everybody owns everything, you know, and I think he's seeing that type of future, and I think he's trying to figure out how do we connect now to there. I certainly think that people are going to demand their own data. We had David Siegel as, you know, one of our interviewees, and he talks extensively about this concept of the personal data locker, and that's the idea that, you know, you essentially have all of your social graph data protected in the cloud, just completely password protected, and you dole it out to services like Facebook and to other, you know, third-party services as you see fit. I think things are going to move in this direction. What was really interesting to note as we interviewed people was that, you know, when we ask them, hey, you know, might not Facebook give over these rights to people and also build out the first, you know, infrastructure for personal data lockers? And that it was like an interesting moment because most of them were very resistant to the idea. A few times we heard people say, but we don't want Facebook to do that. Like, and then Facebook just becomes more dominant, you know, even though they act in a, you know, fairer fashion. You know, there was still a very negative reaction to that.
So that's a paradox. Let me see if I got that right. So Facebook is too dominant if they keep all our information, and they're too dominant if they let us have it back, too. You know, it's a kind of a...
Sure.
How does Facebook win in that case, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, Facebook has already won, I guess, is the argument. They're so big. It's just like, how big does it get? How dominant does it get? I mean, I think, you know, most of them opened up to the reality that, hey, Facebook could react in a super agile fashion and act not like the, you know, the predecessor companies. Like, it is the, you know, as, you know, David Kirkpatrick, who wrote The Facebook Effect, who we interviewed, also said, you know, noted in his interview, it's the most agile company in the history of the world. You know, I think Facebook, there's a strong argument that can be made for that. And if that's the case, you know, wouldn't Facebook, you know, anticipate this kind of stuff and open up, like, in response, because it's just good business. You know, I think that the idea that you can do some really positive pro-social stuff and it's good for business for a behemoth-sized company, I just think that is something that hasn't been possible before, and that maybe that's why that gives people a little bit of brain freeze action.
Absolutely. Well, it is. It's a lot to try to get your head around, that's for sure. So another question for you related to the interviews that you've been doing, and I'll start with Vanessa on this one. What is the single most surprising idea you've heard about Facebook, something that you had not considered at all?
Oh, goodness.
A dreaded question.
Yeah, the single most interesting thing that was said. Yeah, I'm kind of drawing a blank. I don't know, Elvis, if you want to jump
in
first.
Sure, I can hop in first.
I feel like,
we've
heard so many things I really hadn't considered before. I'm trying to think what was the most powerful idea, but maybe if I hear you kind of riff a little bit, I'll come up with one.
Sure. I mean, this one, the one I'm going to, cite is probably not number one, but it's the most interesting one I heard today. I'm so overloaded with Facebook information that's what I'm going to have to choose.
Okay, fair enough.
So,
we wouldn't know the difference anyway, Elvis, right? So you can say anything.
So Jerry Papendorf, who you guys know as well, he today talked about Facebook's potential as a city dashboard. You know, he said that if he gained control of Facebook today, that he would immediately, you know, create a branch of Facebook that more actively went out into the world, opened up offices, and then started to facilitate the quantification of different cities like Detroit, where Jerry's based and running a bunch of really interesting futuristic artistic projects. So I thought that was a really, really novel thing. I mean, just the idea that, Facebook is in a very unique position to take social graph data from a given location or a town or a city, and it can plug that into very useful applications. You know, Facebook is sitting on this, you know, just get to this bigger point, that Facebook is sitting on this gold mine of data, you know, and I think Zuckerberg is very, very wary to even demonstrate the power of that because, you know, whereas it can be this huge enabler on the one hand, it can also be just seen as Big Brother on the other hand. So, you know, like, I think that Facebook will be forced. I think it's a realistic future for Facebook to enable these kind of things, but I think they're going to have to react to market demand. And, like, the timing will have to kind of be right. So I thought that was really fascinating. I could see that being a realistic future.
Well, that's a really interesting one. It's interesting. I've got my, you know, I get to kind of live in two worlds. I live in my futurist speculative world, and I live in the business world at the same time. And the different perspectives on Facebook that you get from talking to people in one community versus the other is kind of a startling thing, because in the business community, there's a lot of skepticism about Facebook. There's a lot of skepticism about whether it really could possibly live up to the valuation that they've given the company, whether it is in fact going to wither on the vine to be kind of a huge flash in the pan. The example I used in the introduction to the show is it the next AOL? I personally have a hard time imagining that. To me, I have as at this point as hard a time imagining the whole internet experience now without Facebook as I do without Google. It seems to me that it's just now become part of the infrastructure. It's part of the landscape now. It's really kind of hard to picture the future without it. But having said that, the idea you just explained sounds an awful lot like the kind of thing we were hearing about for the future of Google 3 or 4 years ago. And you know what I mean? It's like, that didn't happen. Now, why is it going to happen with Facebook?
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I think that there are tipping points, you know, that we approach that make these type of, like, convergences actually possible. You know, so futurists mm-hmm. and sci-fi folks and bloggers, you know, they come up with these scenarios, and they're very optimistic, and I've certainly been guilty of that in the past. You know, but that doesn't mean that they won't happen at some point. You know, the time, like the prediction of like Google, you know, moving into neighborhoods and enabling, you know, like this kind of like local intelligence application. The same thing goes for Facebook, and the same thing goes for Groupon. You know, I think that these things are kind of, you know, inevitable over time. You know, when people get the broadband in place, when people get the smartphone infrastructure in place, you know, and, you know, the bandwidth is there, and the software finally gets, you know, tested enough to actually function, and, like, there's enough fun bred into it, and maybe the apps on top of it are the thing that seals the deal. So, I mean, I guess my main reaction to that is that, sure, the timing of that, you know, is variable. Right, but I definitely remain convinced, based on all the convergence that I see in the information space, that these things are going to be possible, and that these, you know, sorts of things are inevitable. That communities at some point will tap social graph for, you know, great efficiency. I think that's true. Like, the question remains, you know, when.
Yeah, that's a great answer. You know, this is something Stephen and I talk about all the time on this show. Is the fact that a thing has not happened yet is not evidence that it won't happen.
Exactly.
You know, it's consistently offered as evidence that it won't happen. It's like, well, you know, if that were true, nothing would have ever happened, right? Because, you know, things have to, you know, happen for the first time. It's just kind of how stuff works.
I posit that the more that people say it's, you know, going to happen and it doesn't happen, means that it's a lot more likely to happen closer to now than it was.
Yeah. And I think so. So did we give you enough time, Vanessa? You got a really shocking Facebook scenario for us?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's almost kind of talking about the same thing, but through a little bit of a different lens. I like the more aspirational futures. And so I guess the thing that was coolest to me was when people talked about the platform being used as potentially some sort of a catalyst for self-actualization. So, I mean, all this kind of talking about it more in a quantitative sense and about efficiency, but the other side of that is imagination and creativity. Actually, Jerry Papendorf kind of talked about evolution, like, through those two lenses of quantification and imagination. I thought that was a really cool way to look at it when you think about the way that people operate and how we're motivated. It's like, once you can measure it, then suddenly it becomes what we're focused on and what's important. And sometimes, oftentimes, if you look at the banking industry and our global economy, that can become a bad thing if you get too focused on the numbers and you forget about what was the intention was supposed to be. But, you know, once you can kind of quantify, then you can jump off from that point and build upon that with imagination. So if you look at it that way, if Facebook were to allow us to help us to get a more granular representation of our personalities, having more robust profiles where it's not just, you know, just your friends and your favorite bands and this, you know, political affiliation, but kind of pushing it out into, you know, your passions, your skill sets, your interests, you know, just really just a lot richer information. And then if we had access to our own social graphs, then we can start to look at different ways that we can connect with other people and, you know, build up pieces of ourselves with those people. Another interviewee that we had early on, this gentleman named Valdis Krebs, and he's been a social network analyst for over 20 years. And it was really interesting to hear from his point of view. He's like, you know, he's like, as someone who's looked at this for a long time, you have no idea the power of the information when you know how to analyze a social network. If you can see where the key players are, who the big nodes are, who people are connected to, what they're connected to, what they know, that's super valuable information. I mean, that gives you the access to knowing how to achieve goals. And you know, Facebook has that information now, and I hope that they turn that information back over to the users, because I think that, like, right now I see that as a bottleneck that's really preventing the next level, and hopefully they're planning on just kind of blowing that open. That would be, I think, fantastic to just see what will people do with the next level of information. And as all this mentioned, it can be used either way. I mean, governments also want that information so they can watch what their constituency is doing, and if someone, you know, especially in a place where it doesn't have as democratic ideals as we do here in the West, you know, certain key players they'd want to remove, you know, wherever people are clustering around those nodes of influence and attention, those are threats. But, you know, from the other point of view, being able to cluster around people who are really energetic and making good things happen in the world, you know, that's also something we want to see. So it's kind of like, in that sense, it could be a neutral tool that goes either way based on the intentions of the user.
Okay, well, I'm sufficiently intrigued by that answer that I'm going to let's do kind of a road test of that one right now. Stephen, I'm going to ask this question to you, and at the same time, I want folks in the chat room who would care to
yes.
to answer this question. Do you see yourself in the future? Do you see a future where you will be self-actualizing through Facebook, and if so, how? That's your question, Stephen.
You fried his brain.
Stephen, you with us? Have you turned your mic off? He's just had it. He's had it with that kind of question. Okay, well, I'll Stephen, if you're with us, we cannot hear you. So talk every now and then, and we'll see if
hey,
you...
Y'all hear me now. Okay.
Yeah,
apparently I muted the call with my face. But anyway...
It happens.
Anyway, my thought is this, that yes, I do see this as a tool to self-actualize, but here's why. I think that social networks have the power to make us actually better people, because think about it this way. What if it were to develop in this way where, you know, people have a particular need, and they kind of let it be known out on the network that they have this need, and some, you know, someone comes along and fills it. It might be as simple as like a lady needing groceries delivered to her house or something, is a shut-in or something like that. And she puts it out, and one of her friends on Facebook brings her groceries or something. That, you know, what if there was a system built so that that person was then like, given points or something, and when they had a problem, then they could kind of cash that in within the network. I see that as the power to live a little closer to the golden rule. You could criticize that and say, well, you're not really doing it in a selfless way because you're hoping to gain some points. I don't think that's the point, though, is it? You want to, you want to just encourage good, regardless of what the reason is behind people doing it. So,
I completely agree. I think that, I tried to ask the question as skeptical sounding as I could, but I'm completely convinced that that if not Facebook, somewhere within social media. People have to be able to self-actualize. I mean, the bottom line is they're living their lives there now, right? They're forming their relationships there. They're meeting people there. Their friendships are there. Increasingly, their work is there. If people can't self-actualize through an environment that has become so pervasive and so much a part of their lives, then that's a big issue.
They're wasting a lot of time if they can't, you know.
Yeah, well, that was when Betty White hosted Saturday Night Live. Did you see that?
Yes, I missed it.
You know, they had done this this big Facebook campaign to get her to host Saturday Night Live after she had done a Super Bowl commercial, right? So Betty White, octogenarian actress, she's on Saturday Night Live hosting. She's delivering her monologue, and she says, first off, I want to thank all these people on Facebook who don't even know me and I've never heard of for recommending me to host Saturday Night Live. I had never heard of Facebook before this
Well,
Stephen, I think we've lost Phil probably for a second.
Yeah, that was strange. Albus, we have had some glitches in our time, but that was an unusual one.
The glitch.
we can definitely call it that. Well, let me just throw out a question.
Sure.
I assume we still have both you and Vanessa on board, right?
Yeah, and I have a response to you too.
Okay, go ahead. Why don't you go ahead with your response, and I'll hold my question.
Okay, just two things based on what you had said. Well, one thing that Phil was just saying about, you know, it only makes sense that we would be self-actualizing through this tool, this place. We go to Facebook. It's where we live our lives. And I just want to kind of throw out the notion about the online and offline worlds merging and converging. That's been definitely like a theme that has arisen in almost every interview. And when we talk about Facebook as a place, that's almost a little bit, like when I hear that in my mind, what I'm seeing is me sitting down in front of my computer back in my office by myself and just looking at a screen. And I think what is happening is because of the rise of inexpensive small mobile devices, that distinction of online, offline is going to kind of go away. And Facebook isn't really a place that we go to self-actualize, but rather as we're moving through the physical world, living our lives, Facebook is just kind of coming with us. And we're bringing our friends with us, and we're sharing the experiences that we're having in the world with the people that we choose to share that with. So I think that's like a really important thing to kind of think about, that it's not so much that, like, we're seeding our lives in order to like interact via this interface, but rather perhaps, you know, enriching our day-to-day lives by being able to share our experiences with more people that we care to share them with. And then the second thing I just wanted to say was you kind of nailed it with talking about delivering the groceries and getting the points. I mean, that's been something, too, that a lot of people have talked about as the next kind of layer that we're going to see start really forming now that the social layer, if you want to say the Facebook is one and social layer is there, that the next kind of layer that's going to start being built is this game layer. That now we're looking at the gamification of the world where, you know, Facebook now has Facebook credits that as of July, any kind of gaming you want to do through their system or any kind of virtual goods that you want to buy, you're going to have to buy through Facebook credits. So it's like the currency of Facebook. So you can imagine that you can begin getting Facebook credits for different things that you do or different, you know, in terms of the commercial world, different brands that you interact with will reward you with points if you mention them or if you take a poll by them or watch a video that they're posting, you know, and that's not really doing much good for us kind of thing. But in terms of, like you said, kind of becoming the golden rule and the Good Samaritan, that more and more deeds that we do, if we can get rewarded with points, maybe we'll be more interested in doing things that now kind of maybe seem like a hassle or chore or like volunteer work, charity, that's not fun. How do we make it more fun? And I think that the rewards will go beyond just even a Facebook credit or even something that is like a currency as we know it. But that's like another thing that I'm really interested in is the rise of like these social currencies. So your reputation points and your scores and kind of like this kind of goes back into your profile. Is it's not just about who you say you are, but it's about what you actually do and how that benefits the lives of others. And you can start to really build out a profile of really what kind of a benefit that you offer to the world. And then you can kind of trade on that, like really trading on your reputation and trust in order to make other things happen. So I think that's something very interesting to watch.
Absolutely. I look forward to seeing that develop. It's gonna be interesting. I think we have Phil back on. Phil, are you there?
I am back on. Sorry about that. I was going to say what did I miss, but I think I'm caught up.
Yeah.
Other than I felt like I must have offended everyone with my Betty White story because suddenly it got very quiet right around the time I was going.
that was Skynet jumping in and jamming the signal of your Betty White story.
No doubt. No doubt.
Or as we've discovered on our interviews, BlueNet, Facebook becoming Skynet. So it could have been BlueNet also.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Well, my final question was, I think Vanessa has actually touched on it, was, Alvis, one of the things I had read on the description of the project was this scenario where Facebook becomes the world's largest bank. Does that grow out of Facebook credits, or how would that happen?
Yeah, that's certainly the idea. It can happen in a variety of different ways, but clearly Facebook is making a big credits play, and that's the simplest kind of scenario to imagine. All of a sudden, Facebook has 600 million monthly users that check in at least like once a month, and like probably 150 million incredibly active users. We're approaching the point where it's been predicted that in about 2 years, most users of Facebook will access it on mobile. Right now, it's a huge percentage. I think something like 70% of international users that are non-US use it on mobile already. So I think that you imagine this mobile phone platforms, diffusing through the world. Everything, the smartphones will be equipped as of later this year with near-field communication, NFC, which is just swipe credit technology. And all of a sudden, for the first time ever, Facebook credits could be a meaningful means of transfer of currency that's totally secure because the servers are in the cloud. Everything's protected in the United States on Facebook servers, not locally, not in a local bank. And it becomes a, default bank for all these people, it's certainly like at a lower dollar amount, lower monetary amount, but still incredibly significant, I think, in terms of the potential global reach of it in that capacity. So I think it's very realistic.
Absolutely, it's an astounding scenario, but one that I think has some plausibility to it. Well, listen, I'm going to have to let that be the last word because we have burned through an hour just as we always do. Alvis, always a pleasure having you on. Vanessa, very nice meeting you, and look forward to having you both on to talk about this a little further somewhere down the road as the project progresses.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Phil. And Stephen. Just before we go, I just wanted to also mention that, we've got futureoffacebook.com up and running where you can access information about this project. And also wanted to give a big shout to InnoTribe, this wonderful research arm of financial messaging software company Swift that has given us a nice donation to the Open Foresight project. So I just wanted to get that in there before wrapped up.
All right. Well, thank you to them for supporting Open Foresight. And thank both of you for being with us this evening. Stephen, what is our music?
We are continuing through the EP that's been put out by Modern Science. The song tonight is "This Is How the World Ends." It was the other choice last week, and that was not chosen by our panel. And I think we'll like
it. All right, "This Is How the World Ends." So possibly Facebook related. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks once again to our guests for being with us this evening. Everyone in the chat room, everyone listening live or via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back on with The World Transformed 1.5 on Saturday, an archive show on Monday, and 1 week from tonight, Reichert von Wolfschild and some special guests join us to talk about the Bill Conference, which was just completed a couple of weeks ago. So hope you can join us for all of those programs. And until next time, live to see it.